Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Michael Buzzy, Randy Olson, and joining us again for the second time, and we're so honored to have you back, is Vonda Proshkova. Welcome back, Vonda.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here for the second time.
So last week, Vonda joined us to talk about how she is raising consciousness in Prague and the Czech Republic about Bertha von Suttner, someone we talk about regularly on this show. And we started in that show to talk about the linkages between Bertha's ideas, her example, and the anti-nuclear issue, because Bertha von Suttner, as we have pointed out, died in 1914, so right before World War I, and she did not, in fact, see the nuclear age. Vonda also works in the nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation community, and specifically with youth engagement and education around the issue. And so today's show is going to be focused on this topic, the nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation topic. And we do this show not only because, of course, it's important as any citizen of the universe to know about these things, but also because next week on January 22nd, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons enters into force. And this is an historic treaty deserving of quite a bit of study and conversation. We have done a couple of shows on the treaty. I think we did those around the time of August. So if you're interested in more discussion and an introduction to the treaty and so forth, please check our show archives at virtuesofpeace.com. And the show resources page also that go with those shows are really, really valuable. And so, Vonda, as we talked about last week, you work at an NGO called Prague Vision. And one of the things that Prague Vision did was host this conference and this new translation of Bertha von Suttner's Lay Down Your Arms. So you do that, and you're also involved with a number of projects regarding the nuclear issue. I imagine both concerning Prague Vision and outside of Prague Vision. And so can you talk about that, like the sort of different circles that you work in, and also how you became interested in the nuclear issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's so much to talk about in regards to the nuclear issue and everything that's going on right now. But how I got into the field. So I was doing my undergrad studies in international relations. I was obsessed with, you know, counterterrorism and security studies and all of that. It's all very exciting. And that slowly got me into global security and the idea of deterrence and nuclear weapons, of course. And now here, I'd like to again point out, and I know that we've talked about this last week, but I was an IR major. And like many other students of politics and international affairs or similar fields, I took classes on Cold War and U.S. foreign policy and global security. And all of these classes were, you'd think, that the current state of affairs in terms of the world's nuclear arsenals would be brought up multiple times. Yet this topic was a just neglected completely in all these classes. So I had to read up quite a bit. And the more I read, the more interested I became. So I've been slowly discovering the threat that nuclear weapons present and pose. And so now, you know, many of my peers here in Europe, especially, when I get to talk to them about nuclear weapons, they don't know there are American nuclear weapons in Belgium and Germany and Italy and the Netherlands and even Turkey. And this is, of course, all under NATO's nuclear sharing program. And so when they find out, they are surprised. And because nukes, for many of us, it's just something so unimaginable, especially for my generation. So when they find about this, they tend to want them out and that just don't understand why they're there. So the same way when I was discovering about them, I just completely like didn't understand. And the more I was reading about it, about the whole issue, the more attached I felt to the issue. So still during my BA studies, I've discovered there was an internship vacancy at PNND, which stands for Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament. which is a global network of parliamentarians coming from different states and parties and generally really different backgrounds, but they all agree on the fact that nuclear weapons should be abolished. So I applied and finally got the internship, and I've been with them ever since. So I'm constantly learning about the issue. No way I'm an expert on this, but I also got introduced to countless amazing projects on the way that I now have the privilege to further promote and work on, and also got the chance to create some new programs. So right now, for example, we're building the Gender, Peace and Security program at PNND, which I get to be the director of. But also through PNND, I also got to know Marjan Nurjan, with whom we're now convening Youth Fusion, the Abolition 2000 Youth Network. So the interest in nuclear disarmament only keeps growing, I'd say. And the more people I get to know in the field, the better it gets, because everyone just does it with such passion. And there is so much to work on, and very depressing in a way, but also very, very passionate. And I find it really, really amazing.
Yeah. So the statement that you just made, that, you know, the more you learn and the more people you meet, you become more and more interested. And that just reminds me of Bertha, like the language that she used after she published the Iwafa Nidor. She was swept up into the peace movement, that she did not write the book because she was a peace activist, but she wrote the book and then became swept up into the movement. I also want to go back to the point about why this topic is not really taught in formal education. And do you have any theories as to why it's neglected, the nuclear issue?
Well, so here in Europe, especially in the countries that don't have nuclear weapons, I see how that makes sense for the countries that, for example, don't own nuclear weapons but do have them on their territory. That's a completely different story that I just absolutely don't understand. So again, like Italy and Germany and the Netherlands, it's so many weapons in Europe that people have just absolutely no clue about. But I guess, and again, in the Czech Republic, as a post-former Soviet country or post-communist country, we are very afraid to talk about politics in our schools, just because the times when we did, it wasn't pleasant. So I sense that there is just this, well, that we were scared to talk about politics, but we're trying to be restrained and not really to get into this. So I guess that's part of the reason, at least for the Czech Republic.
Interesting. Okay, I'm just going to open it up to any of the other co-hosts, if there are any questions or follow-up insights.
Well, I have a general question that, you know, it might not actually be possible to answer, but it's something that always rattles around in my head about nuclear weapons and nuclear technology in general. And I'm aware of some of the work that occurs through the International Atomic Energy Agency, but I'm wondering if you have anything generally that you can explain and help to teach me with regard to how there's a differentiation between nuclear weapons technology versus nuclear energy technology. Because it seems like an inevitability that we're going to develop nuclear energy in the future, and progress towards that seems like an obvious good for everyone. Yet the same technology put into a missile is devastating to enormous numbers of people, and we call it a nuclear weapon. And we already have the shell, like we already have the container that the bombs go in. So any development in nuclear energy inadvertently could potentially be, at least from my standpoint, this kind of nuclear weapons technology. And so these treaties, they seem to have this double-edged sword going on, that I'm curious if there's anything in there that you can help unpack so that I can understand the issue a little better.
So on the physics aspect of the thing, I'm afraid I can't really help you, because I honestly don't understand the chemistry behind it. But you were right in saying that many people who are in the nuclear disarmament, well, not industry, but field, are also against nuclear weapons. But that's also often because of the environmental aspects. So often people who are in the nuclear disarmament field, of course, are for, you know, doing things in the climate change and protecting the planet. And nuclear weapons are harming the planet very much. So that goes together. In the Czech Republic, of course, nuclear energy is used and will be. But on the chemistry and physics behind it, I'm afraid that I can't give you any details. I'm a bit lost there too. I took a number of, well, not courses, but read upon it, and went to Switzerland to the reactor there. But it's that goes like beyond my brain, the physics. I don't.
Well, I appreciate it. You actually built a bridge for me there that I didn't have before. So, namely that, like, it's actually an environmental issue at the bottom, not only a humanitarian survival one. And so that bridge is actually useful for me. I for some reason, it doesn't dawn on me that it's not only people that suffer from these things. It's like, no, it's a bigger situation. So that's good. Thank you.
No, yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we were trying to highlight, especially in Youth Fusion and our work there, because you're not alone. The majority of people doesn't really see the link there, but the link's there. And I mean, if you look at like the Marshall Islands or the islands in the Pacific in general, there's so much nature and animals there that just got completely destroyed and swept out of the earth because of the nuclear testing there. And we don't talk about that enough. Mm-hmm. So essential to mention that as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more with Youth Fusion, as I understand it, as you said, tries to highlight that connection for people and the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And as I sort of lay out the conversation for today, you know, we're going to spend the first half talking about Youth Fusion and other networks that Vonda is working in, but also towards the end we'll talk about some international law. There's many different international law instruments. There's a nuclear framework, legal framework, if you will, and the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is one of several instruments. But that treaty does mention, in the preamble, the fact that nuclear weapons pose grave implications for human survival, the environment, socioeconomic development, the global economy, and there's several references to the environment in the treaty, so that's very useful. I'll just open it up to see if Michael, do you have any comment or follow up?
Yeah, I had a question for you, Vonda. Did you say that there is a distinction between discussing the nuclear issue with people who reside in non-nuclear states compared to individuals who reside in nuclear states, as you had said, or would you more so attribute individuals like in the Czech Republic not discussing it, as you had mentioned, more towards the political atmosphere and climate that, you know, of not discussing politics that once existed in the former Eastern Bloc?
That's a really good question. Sense a very, very big difference in between, and depending on where, what state or country you come from. Just we talk about the TPNW. Of course, a member of a NATO country is gonna look at the treaty differently than I don't know, New Zealand, just because we're just in so different positions, and of course. In terms of education, look at how we're learning about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For us in our textbooks, if they mention it, it's clearly something that's fundamentally wrong and that should not have happened. In the US, often when I talk to people, they are still standing by the fact that that's what ended Cold War, even though it was proved that that was not the case. And they're still stand by that it was the the correct thing to do at the time. But I guess that also depends on the age of the person you talk to.
That's a really interesting distinction. Thank you so much for sort of enlightening upon that point.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, and going back to this question about, you know, physics and nuclear energy versus nuclear weapons, and this beginning discussion about, well, we're just not taught this, and that education, as we're learning in this conversation, like the extent of, you know, the ignorance or the angle or the narrative really does depend on where you are and what country you're in. But I think also that it's really hard, like this is like a big issue, right? And it's hard for the average person to just like, where do you begin? We've used the expression in, on this show, enter the forest. Like, where do you enter the forest? Do we enter the forest with physics? Do we enter the forest with Hiroshima? Do we enter the forest with the Cold War, the treaty? So, and what's really refreshing, and we'll talk about this soon, is the connection between, yeah, the nuclear weapons and climate. That's just another way to enter the forest where people who are already engaged and interested in that issue will, as Randy says, build a bridge. But let's talk about youth fusion. So just to get clear, so you used TPNW, and just for our listeners, I don't think we said that's the acronym for the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. You talked about the Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament. And within the Parliamentarian for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament, you met Marzan Nurzan, is that correct?
Yes, she's one of the coordinators for PNND.
Okay,
she's a fabulous woman from Kazakhstan.
Cool. And we're going to play a clip from her in a minute. But so she's working for PNND, and you meet her through that organization, PNND. And she and you convened Youth Fusion, or like what's the story there?
Right. So the full name of Youth Fusion is Youth Fusion, the Abolition 2000 Youth Network. And this youth network was launched as an Abolition 2000 working group. And for those of you who don't know, Abolition 2000 is a large international network, again, in the field of nuclear disarmament. And so under the leadership of Marjan, it has been providing a forum for networking and building cooperation between young individuals, but also youth-led groups involved in various nuclear disarmament initiatives, but also doing our own projects. And so I met Marjan in 2018 and got involved in the network right from the start. And just since then, we have been organizing different activities. So we had our own conferences and different video projects. And so actually, pretty recently, in 2020, Marjan and I wanted to push the network a bit forward, to publicize it more, to build more programs, to also reach the young people who have not heard about these issues yet. Mm. And thanks to the enormous help of our network members, we've managed to sort of rebrand the network and create Youth Fusion with the new name. And so we try to build on the links between, you know, disarmament and peace and climate action and generally the whole, you know, sustainable development, how you can't really focus on just one goal, one SDG, and forget about the others. So, you know, with the SDGs, sustainable development goals, you have the motto to leave no one behind. So we're trying to highlight how you can really focus on, you know, climate action and forget about nuclear weapons or vice versa. And also the intergenerational dialogue, what we see is, you know, how young people can learn from the already experienced voices and so on. So we organize free webinars, conferences, both in person and now online. We publish articles. We're also creating our own podcast plan. So I'm learning a lot here. And with all of this, we're really just trying to inform, educate, connect, and engage our fellow students, activists, and just generally all enthusiasts all around the globe. So it's all very, very exciting.
That sounds awesome. Since you talked about this intergenerational connection, I'm going to play this clip from Marjan Nurjan, and you can watch this entire clip on our show resources page, as well as visit the websites of these various networks that Vonda is talking about, Abolition 2000, Youth Fusion, etc. And so this clip, it's not very long, it's about 2 minutes, and we'll come back and talk about this.
I also would like to give attention to the importance of education. As a young person, and our generation and those who were born after us are not aware of the nuclear threat, of the consequences of nuclear weapons. For us, it's something that was a fear for probably our parents or other generations who were living in the times of Cold War. And therefore, it's necessary to maintain the intergenerational gap, trying to bring together young people with seniors who are having experience, expertise, and knowledge to bring it and transfer to young people, to work for the better present and future generations to live in a nuclear weapon-free world, which is secure, sustainable, just. And I would like to encourage everyone to be proactive, to have a belief. And I think if one decides to work in the field of peace and security and disarmament, I think one should be very passionate about that.
That was Marjan Nurjan, and you can watch the entire clip. That's part of a speech that she gives in The Hague on the 175th anniversary of Bertha von Suttner's birthday. And so it's a really nice sort of 10-minute discussion about herself and a little bit about Kazakhstan and how she got interested in the issue. I opened it up to see if anybody has any comments on that clip or anything that has been said thus far.
Well, I'll kick the ball down the road a little. One of the things that comes to my mind when intergenerational dialogue emerges as a, you know, as a subject is the fact that it's a ancient and archetypal truth that, like, this is a necessity. And regardless of the nuclear issue, right? Like, even in the Egyptian like Egyptian spiritual texts, we see this idea of, you know, Horus having to go down and rescue Osiris, and, you know, that's symbolically representing this, you know, this idea that the youth need to communicate with the symbols of society, which in this case are the older people, right? So people who are elders in the world need to communicate their wisdom to the youth so that the youth can vivify society, right? That's always true. It's always been true, and it's always going to be true. And now we're in a world where the stakes are just higher for the same thing because we have more technological capacity, and the nuclear issue forces us down the same track where the elders in society, like this, you know, think of it like the council of the village, needs to explain the dangers and the duties to the up and coming, you know, the future leaders. So I just wanted to bring this up. It's like, it's always been necessary, but it's more necessary now, oddly enough.
Yeah. And on this show, we have, especially I think with the show that we did with Steven van Hoogstraten, who's the former director of the Carnegie Foundation of the Netherlands. I think it came up in that show, but even if it hasn't, we have discussed, you know, the process of building this normative framework is intergenerational. So it's in part like the passing on of the wisdom, but also what's like the passing on of like, okay, now it's like we need to add this brick to the temple and you're up. And this is a project that's building this normative framework is a project that has to be I think you made that point maybe last week, Randy, about building a temple and it takes, I don't know how many, like many, many, many years, that point. Ben Ferenz has also made that point. And so you know, there's something has been being built for a long time, and now nuclear weapons are part of this project. So I wanted to stress that as well.
Yeah, I mean, just one more link in that chain, right? Like, all of our oldest traditions carry that message along with it, right? So like the Olympics has been happening for quite a long time. And one of the main symbolic ideas is the torch, right? And mm-hmm. the torch gets passed. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, it's because the first group and the second group need to communicate an idea. They need to communicate something. They're part of the same goal. And yeah, so when it comes to a conversation today about the nuclear issue, you know, I was born in 1991, right? So the Soviet Union was all but destroyed by the time I entered the planet. So like the horrors of the Cold War and living in that fear and understanding the conflict between belief systems and the degree of devastation that humanity was willing to go to in order to defend those belief systems was something that I simply was not here to experience. And so I had to hear from people who were there what that meant and why it was so severe and why it was so serious. And, you know, and so this conversation continues to this day, literally up until right now, where here we are.
Yeah. And a week away from the entry into force of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Anybody else?
Well, just in a follow-up to what Randy said about us not living through Cold War, because just the other side of the thing, I think that the fact that we haven't lived through it means that we're not as brought down by the what has happened. And we're more enthusiastic about all the different actions that we can take, as opposed to, you know, the old politicians who's been in their seats for 50,000 years and believe that nothing's ever going to change. And I think that's something, you know, just the strength and the enthusiasm is just something so, so amazing. That's why also I think that Youth Fusion is amazing, because it connects, you know, the wisdom and then the enthusiasm of the young people who are just determined to get things done.
That's really cool.
I think it is also really important to emphasize that while the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union has been about 30 years away, that there are still many individuals who are alive in the world today that are still dealing with the after effects of nuclear testing and nuclear war. The Hibakusha, the individuals from Japan who survived the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are still with us. And individuals who lived through nuclear testing, the two places that come to mind are the Marshall Islands for the United States' testing, and then Kazakhstan for the Soviet Union's testing. And I think Mahjong's connection to Kazakhstan is really profound, in that nearly a quarter of all the world's nuclear testing occurred in Kazakhstan by the Soviet Union at a site called the Polygon. And when I heard where she had come from, I was reminded of this really profound article that I had seen through the National Geographic in October of 2017, titled, "This is What Nuclear Weapons Leave in Their Wake." And it is an entire collection of photographs documenting the individuals still dealing with body malnormalities and other disformities that have occurred, children with tumors and individuals living with cancer as a result of the land being poisoned due to nuclear testing. And that this is still something, while the issue may seem far off, I think it is important to learn from these individuals who are still alive today, so that we can confront face to face the reality and the true horrors of what these weapons can do, and which will hopefully spur our energy to further advance the cause of nuclear disarmament.
Yeah, this is actually an argument that I wanted to get back to when we were discussing the TPNW, is we were working with Karibek Kuyokov from Kazakhstan, and he was born, he's 40 something years old, and he's this amazing artist born without arms as a result of his parents' exposure to radiation from all the nuclear weapons testing. A person that has nothing to do whatsoever with anything that's happened during Soviet Union in Cold War. So yeah, absolutely should not be neglecting these stories, though I think that sadly Sadly, we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and and we brought up this point last time that, you know, war itself, and again, to connect with Bertha and our discussion last time, so there's like the evil of war itself, and there's the evil of particular weapons. And even if we, every country ratified the TPNW, we would still have this other entity to deal with, which is war, which does kill, maim, traumatize people that have nothing to do with, you know, the conflict, if you will. And that's through the collateral damage, the permissibility of collateral damage, which we talked about last time. And for that reason, Bertha says that's the real beast to get rid of. And the focus on weapons is a sort of like minor, but it's like a sideshow. So we talked a little bit about Youth Fusion and this other network or project you're involved with, Vonda, is Move the Nuclear Weapons Money. Can you talk about what that is?
Absolutely. This is my favorite project ever. Just because it's looking at nuclear disarmament, but from a slightly different perspective, a different point of view, and that's nuclear divestment. So firstly, a bit of a background. $1 trillion US dollars is being spent on nuclear arsenals globally over a decade. And this number includes everything from their modernization to their transport, but $1 trillion US dollars is just such a high number. And we think that this money could and should instead be used to help address, you know, the coronavirus pandemic and poverty, protect the climate, build hospitals in underdeveloped countries, achieve the sustainable development goals, or anything that you could think of. And so the number, the $1 trillion, that's such a large, that's just a lot of zeros for our brains. So, but if you break it down, that's around $190,000 every minute of every day. $190,000. So just like imagine how many teachers we could pay with that, with just 1 minute of nuclear weapon spending. Think about what is needed in your personal community. And now, especially during an ongoing pandemic, there is just so many better purposes we have for these investments. And so we're with Move the Nuclear Weapons Money, we're also looking at who is profiting from all of this. Mm-hmm. And it's the companies that produce the nuclear weapons and their delivery systems. And these are so famous names, when you hear them, you don't associate them with nuclear weapons. So for example, Boeing or Honeywell International or Jacobs Engineering, those are all global famous names. But how many people know that these are profiting from nuclear weapons? So Move the Nuclear Weapons Money is an international campaign presenting essentially three steps or goals. First one is to cut nuclear weapons budgets. The second is to encourage divestment from these companies manufacturing nuclear weapons and their delivery systems. And then the third goal is to reallocate these budgets and investments to meet economic, social, and environmental needs. So that's all the different things we could do with such large amounts. And so we're promoting all of this in our webinars and our social media campaign and also live actions. We did a really cool art installation in New York City in 2019, where we physically counted 1 million of fake US dollar notes, each of 1 million USD value. So we had 1 million of these notes, which then adds up to the $1 trillion. So we were physically counting them. And then we had 17 baskets for 17 SDGs. And we were like physically reallocating them. It was amazing. We've done a similar action in London and in Switzerland and so on. Just to, because again, our brains are having such a hard time to process what $1 trillion means. But then when you print 1 million notes, each of $1 million value, like you, it's crazy. And we're also promoting how anyone really can get involved in nuclear divestment. So if one is in a nuclear weapons country, calling on the parliamentarian to introduce or support a legislation that would support nuclear disarmament and divestment. So for you guys in the US, Senator Ed Markey introduced the SANE Act, which is on cutting the US nuclear arsenal. So anyone can ask their representative to support that, because that's what your representative is for. But wherever you are, even if you're in a country without nuclear weapons, there is a strong chance that one of the institutions that you interact with, or even a city that you're in, is somehow investing in nuclear weapons or profiting from them. So anyone can put an inquiry with their bank to end investments in corporations that profit from nukes. The same goes to private pension funds or other institutions that hold shares in public companies. Specifically, students can call on their universities to do the same. And in that, we're referring often to research done by Don't Bank on the Bomb. And they're providing a great statistics on which banks invest in nuclear weapons corporations, and just how it looks like on the global scale. And it's very sad, but also fascinating. Mm-hmm. So, and also this monetary aspect of nuclear weapons has really been highlighted, especially now during the pandemic. You know, when our governments claim that they don't have enough money to pay for our doctors or now the vaccines, but they do have billions to pour into weapons that are not to be used, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So in general, it's a fan campaign. It just provides a different approach to the issue of nuclear weapons and what anyone or what we as civil society can do. Would highly recommend the listeners to check it out.
Yeah, and you can go to our show resources page, and we have a link to the Move the Nuclear Weapons Money. And I want to just add a couple things. One is the amount, $1 trillion US, just to put that into perspective, the amount of student debt in the United States is $1.7 trillion. So interesting that that's even more than we spend on the nuclear arsenal. $1.7 trillion, and it's increasing. That is how much American people owe in student loans. The other thing is this bringing to consciousness the amount that these things cost versus how much better we could spend this money. I mentioned him last week. That was Charles Sumner, who in 1845 gives this speech called The True Grandeur of Nations, absolutely like calls out trial by battle or trial by combat, which very sadly to me was uttered by Rudy Giuliani. He actually does say, let's do trial. I watched it because I couldn't believe, let's do trial by combat. And so in any case, Charles Sumner in this speech says this is just not any way to solve problems that are rash. This is not a rational method by which to solve questions of right. But what he also does in that speech and what he did elsewhere was constantly bring to the attention of people the amount of money that warships cost. And he would point out that like one single battleship cost more than the entire endowment of Harvard. And he said things like, with one ship, we could just build another Harvard. And he would make this claim has been made. And it just reminds me once again of like, and it's just so rational, right? Like we're spending all of this money on this thing. It's just like, it's almost like a drunkard and an addict who's spending all of his or her or their money on heroin. And that money could be, you know, used to cultivate that person and uplift that person. And, you know, it's this society is doing that with this money. And it's like a no-brainer, right? But as Bertha says, reason is very much used to not being listened to. We don't listen to reason, sadly. And so it just, what always, yeah, Vonda, you said, you know, it's somewhat depressing. But on the other hand, you know, young people have this inspiration and they're like really motivated to change things, and that's awesome. But it's like this point about money has been made, and like signatures, you know, like how like back in the day, women gathered several, like this is before the age of social media, you know, like how many millions of signatures and presented them to the League of Nations. And again, Bertha, reason is used to not being heard. So I'll just open it. It's not a very optimistic note, but we do move forward if there's this intergenerational dialogue. And so stressing the importance of the work that you're doing and engaging young people on this. And this is something that we're not going to see, dare I say, in our lifetime. Is that I'm being negative, maybe. I don't know. I'll be quiet.
Well, just to add a little bit of positivity into this, just with the coronavirus pandemic, we really have seen many people noticing that the money going into these wrong places. And we've seen the shift of the need from military security into human security, because people were noticing that, you know, military is not going to save you from a virus. So why do we keep pouring billions and trillions of dollars into it? So the conversation, surprisingly, thanks to, you know, there's a silver lining always. So for me, the silver lining of the pandemic is that people are realizing now that we should really, really shift our priorities. And I think they are noticing that. So,
yeah. And I'll add also, because you talked about how I think it's with the PNND, you're doing like gender, peace, and security stuff. And, you know, the fact that women, you know, have a political voice and do seem to be being heard, have a totally different conception of security is also a cause for optimism. And that conception, you know, has legs and is moving. Anybody else?
I'll open up a potentially challenging conversation. So I'm looking at the Move the Nuclear Money website, and I was curious, like, where does that $1 trillion number come from, right? And so you cite this nuclear weapons cost study released by Global Zero in June of 2011, and I'm looking at that study, and I was very interested to try to understand, like, what are we considering to, like, what are we counting within the pile of money that's associated with nuclear weapons stuff? Like, what is it, like, what's included? Is it only nuclear command control facilities? Is it only research and development? Or is it like the environmental and health costs? Like, how much of these things are getting packaged into the same pile? No, please.
So the trillion that really includes everything from, you know, personnel to the transport. There's also another research. I think it's done by ICANN, I want to say, that says that we're spending around $74 billion in a year globally, which is a smaller number, but I don't think that includes everything. That can be just the modernization and then the maintenance. Or possibly transportation, but in the $1 trillion, that really covers everything. And also, I have to say, many of it is really, it's really hard to find these numbers. The governments are not that open to publicizing these, and also not all countries have them publicly available at all. So it is also partially an estimate, but it's pretty accurate, I'd say. And also the numbers are rising, sadly.
So I ask for a specific line of questioning. It links into what I, you know, the first question I asked this afternoon. But, you know, one of the things that always is very interesting to me is that, like, one of the major like research arms of the US Department of Defense is MIT, right? The Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And so suppose we say, all right, the Department of Defense, you need to cut your funding for this particular line of research. what that ends like in my head, what ends up happening there is that the money comes out of student grants and other research opportunities, and the weapons are going to continue being stockpiled and preserved anyway. And it's just going to get like, and so I'm presupposing a certain degree of, I guess, corruption, but I have this concern that if we just start pulling money out of defense budgets, we're going to be doing damage to the same institutions that we're trying to lift, right? And I don't know if that's actually true, right? So I'm bumping into a tremendous ignorance on my part as to how these budgets are actually allocated and how it actually goes in to creating the kinds of things that we're going to identify as nuclear weapons technology. But I'm wondering, like, is there any kind of precaution built into the message, or, you know, is it just trying to draw people's attention to the nuclear issue, generally speaking?
Well, of course, raising the attention to that is part of the reason why we're doing it. But you're actually just the idea of people losing their jobs. That's a very common argument that nuclear countries use, or people that are pro-nuclear weapons. So they're arguing that if we're going to lower the funds that go into military or research in nuclear weapons, people are going to lose jobs. But we, by giving the money somewhere else, using it for something else, we're also opening a ton of job opportunities in a maybe a relevant and similar sector, but just not used to deter and create these inhumane weapons. So the argument that people are going to lose jobs, or that universities are going to lose money, I don't think that's true.
Anybody else?
Sure, I'll jump in on this. I really appreciated, Vonda, you talking about the sort of visual you did to describe nuclear divestment with, you know, counting out the bills to represent, counting out 1 million bills to then represent the total of 1 trillion that's being spent on this. And I think for me personally, where, you know, like, put your money where your mouth is, for me, is something that rings true for most things. And, you know, people will put money towards something, or nations or governments will put money towards things they view as valuable. And so when you look at that 1 trillion, and, you know, you're talking about how the pandemic has really put into the forefront for us all that nations and governments, especially from these nuclear countries, really were not valuing individuals and as much over, you know, spending all this money on these abhorrent weapons that could literally bring about the end of human civilization. And so then for me, I look at nations like the UK or Canada or most nations in Western Europe that, you know, have universal health care, and they've, you know, put money into that realm to allow citizens to be able to have access to healthcare. Whereas in the United States, we do not have universal healthcare. And then we have these enormous military budgets that are 700 billion plus for the maintenance of weapons and infrastructure. And then I completely agree, when something comes along like the virus, it's like, what good is that 700 plus billion for all this military equipment that in turn will not end up saving you from something like this? It's about, for me, really putting the money towards where it'll best benefit the individuals of the particular nation and of the whole world as a whole, especially when you're talking about nuclear weapons that impact everyone. If they were only used on one nation, the fallout and such, because they're so powerful, would spread onto others. So it's really about viewing, just valuing the individual for me.
Cool. Go ahead, Vonda.
No, just that it's a really good point. And I mean, not to judge on the US, but yeah, the with how much money you're giving into, or your government, sorry, into your education, and with all the student loans. Mm-hmm. As a person who's growing up in a country where universities are completely free, and so that everyone can get, you know, your master's degrees absolutely free of costs. And then there's also scholarships on when you're, for example, when you're out of the city, the state gives you a scholarship so that you could commute to the city where your university is located. That's something. So see, just talking to my friends with all those thousands of dollars of student loans is just something very, I just don't understand it. Mm. As a person who doesn't have to live it, I don't, that's something my brain, I don't understand how you guys still, how this is still an issue in 2021.
You're here.
I just, at least the last time I had this conversation about the different educational systems vis-a-vis US and European countries, at least for one European country, like where you do, like what you do is determined by a test. That is, you cannot necessarily go study law if at 17 years old you don't do well on a test. And once you do, like if you do get into a master's program, and I'm talking about two different countries right now, Belgium and the Netherlands, it's very, very difficult to change. So you could like get a degree in psychology, but you're no longer interested in it. And you really need to find like a faculty sponsor, and that's really hard to do sometimes. So I just want to point out that from, and maybe it's changed over there, I don't know, but like the capacity for reinvention, although you have to maybe go into debt to do it, but I don't think you have to do it actually. You do not have to go into debt. I think that's a myth. But the capacity for reinvention, no matter where you are in your life, I think is easier to do in the United States than other places.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I actually prefer the American system of education over the, at least the Czech system. Mm-hmm. I personally went to a private university that was built on an American curriculum just mm-hmm. so I could escape. Mm-hmm. Czech State University. Mm-hmm. And you're right. So we have to decide on our field of interest and basically our whole degree mm-hmm. Before we graduate high school, even mm-hmm. because you have to apply to these schools. And we don't usually have a major and then a minor. Mm-hmm. And it is stressful when after 3 years you discover that this is not what you want to do. Or even if you change your mind after year one, you have to reapply to a different school. You have mm-hmm. to take entrance exams again. So it is far from perfect, but at least you can do it for free.
Yep,
you have the option.
good. Well, that's a conversation for another day. And I'll also say to link the education thing to the issue of the military and so forth. In addition to the $1.7 trillion student loan indebtedness, many people go into the military so that they can have their undergrad paid for. That's really like the only, for some people, it's the only path to higher education is to enlist in the military. So that's another sort of, connection. And I think that's not really understood by a lot of people outside of the United States. But I think that's very, very sad that, you know, you have to make a choice, either like don't be educated, go in debt, or go into the military. But anyway, the way not to go in debt is to, there's a book called Debt Free Degree. I'll just mention that and you can look it up if people are interested. Let's transition to international law and the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And before the show began, we were talking about like this really, the treaty itself. And if you're listening to this, you can download the treaty from our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. The treaty itself is a preamble that we have discussed, some of the preamble in earlier shows and of course articles. And it needs a whole semester of study at the very least. And so we encourage you to look at the treaty and read some of the language. So we're going to turn to that. And as I mentioned, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is one piece of an entire nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation framework. There are other international legal instruments, such as the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So this is one piece, and this the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons mentions the Non-Proliferation Treaty as the cornerstone of nuclear disarmament, so FYI. But here's a question. So as we've discussed on this show, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which this Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, again, identifies as like the cornerstone, such like core piece of nuclear disarmament, has not really like been respected, arguably, okay? And so we had the Marshall Islands case at the International Court of Justice, where the Marshall Islands, you know, basically said, look, you're not following Article 6, countries who have signed on, nuclear weapon states who have signed on to this treaty, and you're not disarming pursuant to your legal obligations. And in their statements, you know, they mention these like birth defects and so forth. And as we've discussed, the International Court of Justice, through technical reasons, sort of like dismisses that complaint. And so it seems like the Non-Proliferation Treaty is not being respected. The International Court of Justice, which is like the judicial body of the United Nations, is not really like looking at the issue. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has not entered into force after 25 years. And so why should we expect this treaty to make any difference? Even if we discussed on this show, like even if we have, you know, ratifications, you know, you don't necessarily abide by the treaty. And if there is no court to enforce it, and in the case of the International Court of Justice, you know, the United States decides when we're going to go into that court. Anyway, it's a big issue. So the short issue is like, why is this going to make any difference? And I'll just open it up for anybody to answer that.
I'll double down on that actually.
Oh boy.
And then we can continue like searching for a way out. But you know, towards the end of the treaty in Article 17, number 2, it's like, even if you agree, there's always this, you can leave so long as the state party determines that withdrawing from the treaty is something that is in line with its supreme interests, right? So the state party is always, at the end of the day, given the total like control over the situation. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, it's like there's a get out of jail free card built right in.
Yeah, this is I've reread the treaty multiple times before coming on to this, but it's just going back to the ICJ case or the advisory opinion on the threat or use of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So the ICJ determined that the use of nuclear weapons must be compatible with international law applicable in armed conflict. Mm-hmm. And they specifically focused on humanitarian law. So that's the principle of discrimination. So soldier or a civilian, and we know the nuclear weapon won't differentiate between the two. Also severe damage to the environment, unnecessary suffering on the soldiers. So we know, again, nuclear weapon is a inhumane weapon causing harm even after the conflict is over. Also impacting on mutual countries. You know, radiation doesn't recognize borders. So just using these principles from humanitarian law, they came to the conclusion that the threat or use of nuclear weapons would be violating the principles and rules of humanitarian law and the law of armed conflicts. So in fact, here we already see that the use of nuclear weapons is being recognized as illegal. And then they couldn't conclude whether the use of them would be also unlawful in an extreme circumstance of self-defense. So essentially they weren't sure about the principle of necessity of humanitarian law, though over there the other humanitarian laws principles would still hold. But this is where TBNW is pretty much changing this to a solid yes, that would also be illegal. at least for the states that signed the treaty. But see, this is where it gets even trickier, I guess, with the TPNW being only binding for the state parties. And so as of today, there are only 51 ratifications. There was 84 signatories and 122 states voting in favor of the treaty text in 2017. So the number of ratifications can grow. But for now, only 51 states, and none of them are NATO states or nuclear armed states. So it doesn't apply to them. And so we can ask whether it really does change anything. And judging from just the 51 states number so far, it is unlikely that the treaty will attain the customary international law status. So as a member of a NATO country, as a citizen of a NATO country, it's, for me, it is debatable whether it really makes nuclear weapons illegal, because it wasn't ratified by any nuclear weapon state.
Anybody else?
So there's a point we've made on this show many times, and I'm going to make it again because I think that there's never enough times that, you know, what the treaty does seem to do is pile on the evidence for anyone who goes to actually attempt to educate themselves. And so the thing that we've referred to many times is this journal article by Elihu Root called The Need of Popular Understanding of International Law. And this idea within that article is that, you know, when everyday citizens have an understanding of their obligations to the international community, we move closer and closer towards a world where, like, an international peace situation becomes more and more possible. And so it seems like this treaty is, you know, it's something that's, it's idealistic, and it's a goal worth striving for. And the more people who learn about it and think about it and dive into the forest, so to speak, and teach themselves about their obligations and what their countries ought to be doing based on the treaty, it's like it pushes us slightly closer to the goal, which has to do with, you know, public pressure applying on states in order to implement the ideals in the treaty.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think it really opens up a lot of possibilities for the state parties. So they can take this further and adopt some additional implementation methods. So, like, the prohibition of financing, which at Moving Nuclear Weapons Money, we'd like to see that, or no-fly zone, so that airplanes carrying nuclear weapons could not fly in the country's airspace, or other methods. And even though this is hypothetical and none of this has been adopted, this is now where we as the civil society can come in and try to have some influence. And, you know, when they have their parties meeting, the civil society can submit any proposals. So it's just something that we really need to explore now and find how best we can use this new setting for advantage. And also, I really must give them the momentum that they're building for nuclear disarmament. This is something they're doing extremely well, the whole ICAN campaign. Now, you know, many people who didn't follow the nuclear issue at all are now becoming aware of the fact that we still have thousands of warheads. And that's fantastic. And that this is actually what I see as the biggest contribution of the treaty and the movements behind it. That's the publicity they're doing is super important, and they're doing it really well. And that goes well with the education and what Randy was saying.
Raising consciousness.
I also think it's interesting to see sort of the international political dimension of this treaty from, you know, who has been a signatory and a ratifier and who has not. Even nations such as the Marshall Islands, which have been victim to horrendous nuclear testing at the hands of the United States, have not ratified or even signed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons just because of the influence of the United States. You know, they have this sort of quasi-sovereignty under this compact of free association, but you know, we're in charge of their defense and a lot of money gets allocated towards them with this. And so it's all about not, you know, biting the hand that feeds you, so to speak. And then I agree, Vonda, that even if you look at all the NATO nations, no NATO nation has signed on to it either. Neither has South Korea or Japan or, like you said, any other nuclear armed state. But I also agree that the value from it becoming international law, and I'm reminded of Beatrice Finn's part of ICAN when she spoke to Al Jazeera after the treaty had reached its 50th ratification, that, you know, its prowess will come from shifting attitudes and, you know, hopefully more nations, even if they are not nuclear armed, that sign on to it will then put further pressure on the nations that are nuclear armed to sign on to it. And hopefully through education of the public, then the people who reside in those nations can then demand change from their leaders to then sign on to it. So I'm very interested and hopeful and optimistic that this will end up coming to fruition and we can live in a society that is free of such abhorrent weapons.
Just speaking of the Marshall Islands, you know, because when you ratify the treaty, you get this obligation to clean up the messes. So why would the Marshall Islands clean up the messes of those who made them, essentially? But that's just maybe me.
Yeah, exactly.
Overthinking things.
No, I completely agree with that. And one part of this treaty that has always been really interesting to me is Article 6, which talks about all of the rehabilitation that will need to be done. And sort of, and that's like a really super nitpicky sort of international diplomacy and politics aspect of, like, you know, on the United Nations stage, they do have the ability to ratify and sign this treaty. But when a lot of their financial backing and sort of defense and such comes from the United States, that it's like, okay, are you allowed to go outside of this and do this for your own? Because I agree, you know, the United States was the one who did the nuclear testing, and so then they should be the one to clean it up. And so, and even I know Kazakhstan ratified the treaty, and so then what I, this would be something for me to personally investigate, but it's like, you know, it was Russia and the Soviet Union that commenced the testing on Kazakhstan. So then from them ratifying it, is it then Kazakhstan's responsibility to clean up and begin this rehabilitation process? Or would that responsibility then fall to Russia if they were to ever sign and become a ratify the treaty? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And also with South Africa, who's the only country that built its own nuclear arsenal and then dismantled it. And they've ratified. Mm-hmm. And so now we're bound to apply measures towards the environmental remediation on the contaminated areas, citing from the treaty. Mm-hmm. So that's something interesting to me.
Mm. Agreed.
So we've been going for almost 90 minutes, and we did want to talk about 1-2 provisions in detail, but I think maybe we save that perhaps for next week. And Vonda, of course, we would love to have you back if you want to come back next week.
I would love to.
Yeah, and we can talk about specific provisions because, as I've said, I think we all said that this treaty requires a lot more than, you know, like 10 minutes. So let's agree to come back next week. And perhaps, you know, if you're listening to this, you might want to familiarize yourself with the treaty. Again, you can download that. And that will be, I guess, if we meet on Thursday, that will be the day before the entry into force. So that's timely. It's also Martin Luther King week next week here at Central Michigan University. And officially, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is tomorrow. It's not on Monday the 18th. That's a long story of why we push it to Monday. People want a long weekend, basically. But in any case, his official birthday is tomorrow. And I just want to acknowledge that because he saw the linkages between poverty and militarism. And of course, he was a great peace activist, inspired very much by Gandhi, did a pilgrimage to Gandhi's ashram in 1959. So many things to connect. So I'll just go around, starting with Michael, final thoughts on the show, and then we'll close out and come back next week, God willing.
Yes. No, I just wanted to everyone who's listening, truly go educate yourself on this issue. Glance over the treaty. If you know a title of one of the articles jumps out at you, something that you're passionate about, definitely dig into it. And that can be your point of entering the force. I think that whole you know, you are your own, like your first actor in coming to know this. And so find the point of entry of this force and definitely dive into it. It's very complex and daunting on the outside, but once you're in it, it's really fascinating and truly you'll be spurred along. No, I just wanted to reiterate, thank you to Vonda for coming on and speaking with us again this week. Always a pleasure. And I look forward to speaking with you all next week.
Thanks.
So I'll echo Michael's sentiments and point out that, you know, something Vonda said today was that there's this momentum to the nuclear issue right now, and basically anyone can find an entry place or entry point to the forest we've been describing, and you know, whether it's you know, an interest in history and the study of, you know, the atrocities of history and the atrocities of nuclear weapons, like there's definitely a big door there that you can go in. And whether you're sort of a philosophy person and interested in like the beliefs that undergird the Cold War and how that turned into a willingness to annihilate the species, like there's definitely a door to go down there and the psychological component to all of that. Or if you're a STEM person and you want to study atomic energy or the environmental impacts of nuclear weapons and the ways to like remedy them, there's like a big, big door there. And like, or we could go the way we've been going today, which is talking about sort of the legal international components and international relations associated with the nuclear issue. Like there's a big door there. And basically, no matter which direction you're interested in studying, like the nuclear issue is involved in every serious intellectual endeavor. And so now is a good time to sort of build the bridge between wherever you're at and the nuclear issue and see where things connect. So I really appreciate Vonda being here again and, you know, bringing us up to speed, bringing me up to speed on some of the things that are happening in the world today.
Thanks. And I'll speak and then Vonda, you'll have the last word. Just to underscore what Randy just said about, you know, the fact that you really, there's like something for everyone here and there are so many different points of entry. And I think that relates to something that Vonda said earlier about the unity of the sustainable development goals. Like you can't be interested in the climate and not care about nuclear. And this is the holistic approach. Everything is connected. And going back to ancient Greek philosophy, which some of you know I study, there's a doctrine called the unity of the virtues. That is like, if you have one virtue, you have all of them. And you can't have one strength without having other strengths. So I want to stress that I think that there's a connection between this sort of holistic reality and the fact that there are so many different points of entry is because it is this holistic web and fabric. And so Vonda, last word.
Okay, so to conclude this on a very positive note, I recently became obsessed with Hamilton, the musical. And so to quote on the song My Shot, where Hamilton says, "Scratch that, this is not a moment, it's the movement." I really think that this moment is becoming the movement. And you know, there's just so many things happening, and the US will have a new president soon, and the UN Secretary General will open the conference on disarmament, and so many young people are getting involved. Soon, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists will announce the annual new setting of the Doomsday Clock. Unfold Zero is organizing a global appeal to end the nuclear threat. So there's just so many ways to get involved in, and I'm very excited to be able to witness it all and to engage in these activities. So thank you for contributing to this debate. It's been an absolute pleasure to be here with you again. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace, and Vonda Proshkova has been our special guest. She is joining us from Prague, the Czech Republic. Stay safe and be well. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.